people just try to box up a bunch of stuff. They just send it. Oh, here are a bunch of wool blankets, Haiti. Here's a bunch of hand sanitizer, Nepal. Good luck. We're all rooting for you.
The coverage of natural disasters spurs us to action, but maybe not the helpful kind. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Also, how to cover ridiculous stories, like that one about the government takeover of Texas.
These are kind of like the stories you'll hear at a backyard party. Two guys standing by the fence with beers in their hands, one guy telling the other the true lowdown on what's about to happen.
Plus, the creator of Veep on why Washington, D.C. makes great TV.
In the news and in current affairs, there is a vacuum because politics isn't progressing. And in that vacuum come idiots like me and turn it into entertainment.
There's more coming up. Stay with us. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. It's been 2 weeks since that horrific earthquake in Nepal. The fact is, the coverage is winding down, following a narrative arc that's replayed without alteration whenever the earth convulses.
Many of Nepal's ancient temples and cultural gems are in ruins. And on Mount Everest, an urgent rescue response is underway as marooned climbers struggle to stay alive.
A Spanish search team has now arrived to help. So far, they've only found body parts.
In Nepal, a miracle in the rubble. A 101-year-old man was rescued on Saturday. He had been trapped underneath his home for 8 days.
New pictures show the desperate scramble for supplies dropped in one of Nepal's remote villages.
But the biggest threat now is the spread of disease after the earthquake.
A familiar story, but is it the real story? We begin this hour with a new breaking news consumer's handbook, The Tectonic Edition. Jonathan Katz was working for the Associated Press in Port-au-Prince in January 2010 when an earthquake rocked Haiti, the worst natural disaster in the Western Hemisphere. After Nepal was struck last month, he was moved to write a piece in the New York Times called How Not to Report on an Earthquake. He observed that the first 72 hours are the most important to find survivors, and that's exactly when journalists and first responders aren't there.
If you go to Haiti and you talk to people who were in the quake zone, everybody knows somebody who was trapped in the rubble. Everybody knows somebody who was pulled out. The vast majority of rescue work that's going to be done after a disaster is going to be done by fellow survivors of the disaster. And this is missed in disaster responses both domestically and internationally. I was looking for the highest possible number that I could find for the number of people who were saved by the international organized search and rescue response. And the absolute top highest number that I could possibly find was 211. If they came in and understood, actually the lead rescuers in this situation are the actual people who live in these neighborhoods, they would have said, you tell us where we need to go. Where are people trapped? And where do you think there might actually still be a chance to save people? And maybe in that case, a lot more people could have been saved.
So what is the risk of over-reporting these fancy international search and rescue efforts and under-reporting the work the locals do in saving their neighbors?
There's a big problem and a massive problem. I just heard a report from Nepal. There was a military officer, I think in the U.S. Army, and he was speaking to the radio reporter, and he was telling them that they had search and rescue teams with them. It had been more than a week since the earthquake struck. Obviously, if it was somebody in my family or a loved one, like, of course, I would want to move heaven and earth to try to get them out. But realistically, it's unlikely that that's going to happen. And so it's frankly sort of a waste of time and money that could be better spent saving people's lives in other ways. That's the big problem.
Mm-hmm.
The massive problem is that it reinforces the notion that the people who have gone through an earthquake are basically going to be useless. They need to be shoved out of the way while these much better, wiser interventions are brought in from the outside. And that's so the opposite of the way it actually works.
Talk to me about the coverage of disease.
Of course, there are going to be health issues following a disaster. And the most immediate are going to be extremely traumatic injuries, crush injuries, concussions everywhere, and things that are much more complex than that. But we imagine from the outside that there's only going to be one kind of big medical issue, which is going to be the epidemic.
Lack of clean water, that sort of thing? Communicable diseases, because they're all crowded together.
Right. And then that's going to somehow spark a major epidemic. It almost never happens. There's all kinds of studies that have been written about this. You can go back and read them in the Journal of Emerging Infectious Diseases and other places. People go back and they look because they want to know specifically what kinds of epidemics arise after disasters and especially earthquakes. And the answer is none.
So dead bodies.
This is something that I've seen, you know, misreported over and over and over and over again. This morning, there was a piece online at The New Yorker that seemed to imply that the dead bodies could somehow spark an epidemic. It just doesn't happen like that. There's no evidence that a dead body who's been killed by blunt force trauma is going to be any kind of vector of disease.
And one story from NBC News that you called an absolute effing train wreck was...
The headline was, "Will Haiti's Hell Come to Nepal After Earthquake?"
Mm-hmm.
First of all, the cholera epidemic that erupted in Haiti, it was 9 months after the earthquake, came from Nepal. And they acknowledge that in the story, which really makes it make absolutely no sense. It was in a part of the country that was not affected by the earthquake. It spread down a river going in the opposite direction away from the area that had been affected by the earthquake. There was a piece in Foreign Policy that talked about this. Again, it name-checked the fact that cholera was imported into Haiti by United Nations peacekeepers. But part of the reason why the epidemic was so bad was because so much infrastructure had been destroyed in the earthquake. No! Unfortunately, in Haiti, there was no water and sanitation infrastructure to be destroyed in the first place. Try as hard as you can. You can't make the cholera epidemic in Haiti a result of the earthquake. Man, people want to, but you can't. It just doesn't work.
Let me go through a few of these other tropes. You suggest that news consumers regard with skepticism media reports about increased crime and violence in the affected area.
Yeah. So when you get to that 72-hour mark and we start having to spin these stories forward, we start looking for, okay, well, what can happen next? We have certain narratives that are already in our minds, and frankly, most of them are myths. So one of them is the idea there's going to be an epidemic. The other one is unrest. And unrest is reported in almost always the exact same way that the threat of epidemic stories are reported, which are fears of unrest, signs of looming trouble. The word that you often see in these stories is desperate. Desperate earthquake survivors, this idea that you have poor, desperate people and well-intentioned, good people who are experts who come in from the outside and they're going to help those people, but you never know what the desperate person is going to do because they're desperate.
Words like desperate may set the stage, but, you know, you're not suggesting that reporters actually make up stories about crime and violence, are you?
No, it's not that reporters make them up. I think the better cliche phrase is that a hammer finds a nail. I can take you back to my own experience when I was a wire reporter on the ground. You expect for there to be violence. You expect for there to be unrest. And you don't want to miss this story. And your editor certainly doesn't want you to miss the story. And frankly, viewers expect the story too. So you mount up, you get in your car, and you start asking questions. Hey, has there been any violence? Have you guys heard of any looting? Have you heard of any kinds of problems? And especially in a major metropolitan area, a place like Port-au-Prince, people will say, sure, there's a problem down there. You know, we heard that, you know, maybe there were criminals in this part of the city. And you go there and maybe there's nothing, but maybe there's something.
Are you seeing this in the coverage of the Nepal situation?
That is a very interesting question. One major difference in terms of the way that U.S. media cover Haiti compared to the way that they cover Nepal, and this is unavoidable, we have to talk about it, is the fact that nearly everybody in Haiti is black. And we cover things that happen to or are being done by black people in a different way than we cover things that are being done by other people, including South Asian people who live in Nepal.
Okay, what about the late miracle story?
I understand completely why people love these stories. There's so much death. There's so much loss. The historic buildings and the temples and the monuments are gone. And it's just so sad. And people want something that they can hold on to. And frankly, we know that that story is going to get a huge response. We know that story is going to go viral. By the way, just to be really cynical about it, another reason why media outlets love late rescue stories is because oftentimes they themselves relate to getting to the disaster zone. And so, like, it's something to cover a couple days later.
By the time they get there, the major story is over.
But you can still do this story of the person being pulled from the rubble and shouting hallelujah. But you're talking about maybe one person or two people who are going to be pulled out of the rubble at that late a date. And now you need to spin the story forward. And so you start looking for, well, what are the next problems going to be? And so you start writing the threat stories. What they'll try to do often is grab onto a couple of small examples of each of these things. Maybe a couple of people got sick here, or the police shot somebody over there. And from that point on, the coverage is sort of forced into this awkward position of having kind of overpromised a follow-on disaster that never comes. But if you're in a major metropolitan area, you're talking about millions of people who are now engaged in a very real drama for survival. And it's something that's very important to focus on, because when you're talking about the myths of disaster, it can be very easy to be like, okay, so there isn't going to be unrest and there probably isn't going to be a famine. So are you telling us that everything's cool? No, everything is distinctly not cool. Just because there isn't going to be a massive disease outbreak doesn't mean that you aren't going to possibly see, for instance, increased incidence of a disease like tuberculosis, because people are living in close quarters with one another. Or if you're in a place like Nepal, where cholera is an endemic disease, some increased cases or something like that.
So you're saying it could happen because they're living in close quarters?
No. What, you might see some increased incidence of tuberculosis, but you're probably not going to see a massive outbreak of tuberculosis. You might see some children die of diarrheal diseases and you don't even know what they are. And they're not widespread enough for you to even quantify it as being a specific epidemic. And that's just one example. In all of these instances, people are going to need to rebuild their lives. They're going to need to rebuild their incomes. They need to find a stable place to live. And we are really bad at that in terms of international response. People don't get that kind of help.
You know, isn't a signal that the story is over when the journalists lament the long and difficult recovery as they pack up for home?
Yeah. And the irony is that that is the story, and that that was the story from the minute that the earthquake struck. And a big part of it is that we were focusing on the wrong things and we were asking the wrong questions from the very beginning. But the idea that there's panic, that there's desperation, is a bad narrative. The people who are taking that narrative in respond to it. And so you end up with situations where, first of all, people just try to box up a bunch of stuff. They just send it. Oh, here are a bunch of wool blankets, Haiti. Here's a bunch of hand sanitizer, Nepal. You know, good luck. We're all rooting for you. And that causes all kinds of coordination problems. It clogs up the entry of things that may actually be needed. If we're going to be of any use at all, it's going to be in helping them take the leadership in their own recovery. We see the images on TV and we imagine, like, the international responders. They're the ones who are there, you know, doing the life-saving work. They're the ones who need the support. Whereas we may be conflating totally different things. We may be watching, you know, firemen from France responding to a disaster, and that inspires us to give money to the American Red Cross. When the earthquake struck in Haiti, the American Red Cross raised $486 million. They had four people in Haiti at the time of the earthquake. If people understood that it's the survivors of a disaster who are taking the lead in their own recovery, we're going to start looking to help them directly. This is not an opportunity for us to show how powerful and good we are. When we're looking at disasters, especially ones that happen in other parts of the world, I think the most important thing that we could do as journalists to communicate is it's not about us.
Jonathan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Journalist Jonathan Katz is the author of The Big Truck That Went By, How the World Came to Save Haiti and Left Behind a Disaster. After a calamitous earthquake, we crave what is least obtainable, certainty. When will the next one be? Where? How bad? Hell's bells, why can't you tell us?
God forbid, Dr. Graves, that if that big one that everybody has been predicting that would make its way to California, Los Angeles, San Francisco, maybe there would not be as much damage as we're seeing in the Nepal situation because there's better infrastructure. Or am I wrong?
Earthquakes always bring out the armchair expert, says Susan Huff, a seismologist at the U.S. Geological Survey. But predicting earthquakes or even estimating their potential harm is a thorny exercise that hinges, she says, on countless crucial imponderables.
For example, if an earthquake happens in the dead of night, it can make a big difference if a population center experiences weak shaking, which might inspire people to run outside. In a place like Nepal, where buildings can and do collapse, that may end up saving lives. Little things can matter. There was a 2001 earthquake in western India. It happened on Republic Day, a holiday in India. More people were inside watching television, watching parades, than normally would have been the case. And that made a difference for the death toll.
So if you do get those factors, the vulnerability of the building stock, the time of day, the day of the week, the length of the shaking, can you plug those things into a computer then and get a really good estimate?
We really can't come all that close. The USGS has a system called Pager that does these calculations. The numbers I saw, there was a 1/3 probability in Nepal that the fatalities would be between 1,000 and 10,000. And there was almost as high a probability that they'd be between 10,000 and 100,000. And there was actually a 17% chance that they would be greater than 100,000. So that's a huge range, but that really does reflect the extent of uncertainty dealing with human life losses as a math problem.
The initial reports put the death toll at 1,900. That quickly rose to 5,000, then more than 7,500. Now, some experts say the toll will top 10,000. And Max Vies, who's a respected analyst of seismic hazards, recently calculated that the eventual death toll could top 57,000. How do we reckon with that range?
So in this case, the media is watching science in action, watching research play out and results sort of fly around that may not reflect a consensus of the scientific community. Normally, that plays out behind the curtain. But when an earthquake happens, all of a sudden, the process can splash into the media.
And you've suggested that pumping the numbers up prematurely and then knocking them down later could create a kind of complacency?
It isn't like somebody out there is pumping them up on purpose. The death toll really was quite a bit lower than we would have expected. You know, we know that Nepal and Kathmandu have been enormously vulnerable. And now we've seen a big one, if not the big one, and the death toll is going to be on the order of 10,000 and not hundreds of thousands, as people have feared. So there is a concern that people might get the message that, oh, well, the big one there or maybe anywhere else isn't going to be as bad as the experts are saying. And that would be the wrong message to take away from this, because it does appear that this was a very unusual earthquake for the kind of shaking it generated. There's just no reason to believe that future earthquakes, they're going to be as kind.
Past performance is no guarantee of future results.
The magnitude of an earthquake doesn't tell the whole story in terms of the actual shaking that it generates.
All right. What was so special about the way it shook in Nepal?
That, I think, is going to be the most important science story. It was what we call very long period motion. If you look at videos from Kathmandu, in the strongest motion, the ground is going back and forth over the course of about 5 seconds. It's sort of like a very long swell in the ocean. So you have buildings that are quite short. If you imagine little ships on very big swells in the ocean, those ships may be able to ride out the waves without too much damage.
Mm-hmm. And in the coverage of earthquakes, you have noticed an interesting side story, the prediction of the next quake.
We can't predict earthquakes, and so you're not seeing reliable predictions. But predictions come out of the woodwork after a big earthquake has happened. I heard an esteemed colleague asked after the Northridge earthquake in 94 if anyone had predicted the earthquake, and he said, not yet. People will come out and they'll say either we predicted it or, look, here's some signal that happened before the earthquake and the earthquake could have been predicted. That's what people want. You know, they want to know, is the big one going to hit tomorrow or 50 years from now? And that's what we just can't tell them.
Have you ever been in one?
Oh, yeah. There was the Northridge earthquake, magnitude 6.7. I was sound asleep, and it's like somebody comes along and, with absolutely no warning, picks up your house and starts shaking it back and forth as hard as they can. It was incredibly loud. That was one of the surprises to me. There were transformers exploding. There were car alarms going off. There was the house creaking. You know, I'm an earthquake professional, but they are scary.
Susan, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. It was nice talking to you.
Susan Huff is a seismologist at the U.S. Geological Survey. You can find the one-page printable version of the Breaking News Consumer's Handbook Tectonic Edition at onthemedia.org.
Coming up, the surveillance we hate, the surveillance we love, and the perils of both.
This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
If you're hungry for a new podcast, I suggest The Sporkful, hosted by Dan Pashman, who's really funny. It's not about chefs or restaurants. It's about humans and how weird they are about food. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts or in the WNYC app.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, a federal appeals court landed a stunning blow against a major NSA surveillance program, the one that hoovers up all the data on the phone numbers you call and how long you stay on the line. The court ruled that the provision in the Patriot Act that supposedly authorizes it actually doesn't. The wording of the act, specifically of Section 215, would have to be broadened to make it legal. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and Senator John McCain were displeased with the decision.
The expiring provisions of FISA are ideally suited for the terrorist threat we face in 2015.
It's pretty clear that 9/11 could have been prevented if we had known about some of the communications that went to those who committed this terrible atrocity.
Now, Section 215 is one of the Act's three provisions set to expire on June 1st. And in the wake of Ed Snowden's revelations and the court's decision, the Congress will be watched closely. Jeff Stone is a professor at the University of Chicago. 2 years ago, he served on the review group, which advised the president on NSA surveillance. He says this week's ruling focused on a single word in the statute, relevance.
The court said basically you can't sweep in all the phone data in the United States because it might in some conceivable way turn out to be useful in the future in an investigation. The court said basically that's not what this statutory provision authorized. It was basically authorizing a much more limited, much more subpoena-like type of activity, and that this goes wildly beyond what the word relevant has ever meant in American law.
Now, the ACLU had a constitutional argument that the judges didn't address in their decision. It claimed that the program violates our Fourth Amendment protection against warrantless search and seizure. The court ducked that. How come?
Well, it's not really fair to say it ducked it. I mean, a court is supposed to decide cases on the narrowest ground available. And in this case, having found that the program violated the statute, there was no need to then go on and address the constitutional question because they'd already decided that the program was invalid.
Okay, well, how about the government's argument that those phone numbers are owned by the phone companies, not by the public, so the public can't claim the right to keep them private?
Right. So on the Fourth Amendment issue, here's the dilemma. The court has said that individuals have Fourth Amendment rights when the government intrudes on their reasonable expectations of privacy.
Mm-hmm.
So the court actually held in the 1970s that when the government wanted to get information about an individual's phone records, they could get that information from the phone company without any Fourth Amendment issue because that person had voluntarily exposed the information to the phone company. And that's been the law for the past almost 40 years now. The challenge that is raised here is to what extent changes in technology should cause us to re-examine what were previously thought to be non-reasonable expectations of privacy. So a good example of this historically is what the court did with the problem of wiretapping. In 1928, when the Supreme Court first considered whether wiretapping was a search under the Fourth Amendment, it said no, because a search was defined historically as a physical intrusion into some physical space that you own or occupy. It wasn't until 40 years later, until 1967, that the Supreme Court finally said, because of the changes in technology, a wiretap was a search under the meaning of the Fourth Amendment, even though it did not involve a physical intrusion into a physical place. And we're now at a similar point in which we have to step back and reevaluate concepts that may have made sense in the 1960s and 70s, which in light of new technology really doesn't make sense anymore. That issue eventually is going to be addressed by the Supreme Court, and it'll be very interesting to see what it does.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and Senator John McCain have reacted to the judge's ruling by doubling down and saying that 9/11 could have been prevented with this kind of bulk collection program.
Well, the truth is, that's an overstatement big time.
Didn't the president's review group on which you served find that the phone metadata program, I'm not talking about the other surveillance programs, but that the phone metadata program specifically was noteworthy for its lack of effectiveness?
We basically found that in the time that the program had existed, there was no clear evidence that the information gathered from it had been critical in thwarting any particular terrorist attack.
So what do you think of President Obama's suggestion to change Section 215 so that the government isn't holding those records, the phone companies are holding them more or less in perpetuity?
So this was basically the recommendation of the review group. What we concluded was that the primary danger of the program was that the government itself had in its possession billions of bits of information about American citizens, which could reveal all sorts of private things about whether someone is seeing a psychiatrist, whether someone's having an affair, what religion, what church they go to. For the government to have all of that information is a potential disaster. There had not been a disaster. There are lots of safeguards in place. But the fact is, you can always have another J. Edgar Hoover or some other leader who decides, I'm going to circumvent those safeguards. I'm going to dig into that and find out about my political enemies. So the recommendation we made was that the government should not be allowed to collect or to retain the data. If and when the government could demonstrate that it had reasonable and articulable suspicion that a particular phone number was being used by a terrorist, that it could then get a 215 order that required the phone companies, which have the data anyway, to reveal the connections that that phone number had to other persons, but that the government itself would not have the information in its possession. And that's what the USA Freedom Act, the legislation that is now pending in Congress, recommends.
And just to draw a line under what you said earlier, it's not because of abuses of the program that have taken place, but because it creates an architecture for terrible abuse in the wrong hands.
Correct. The fear is simply that the government is in possession of this extraordinarily huge amount of data and that we don't want the government to have even the temptation to dig into that data for the wrong reasons.
So do you have any idea where this decision will take us? What happens next?
Congress is going to have to decide whether it wishes to authorize the telephone metadata program under Section 215. That's up in the air. But my hope is that in the end, Congress will adopt the pending legislation. We will then have a law that is much more carefully drawn and eliminates this program.
Jeff, thank you so much.
My pleasure, always.
Jeff Stone is a professor of law at the University of Chicago. 2 years ago, he also served on the president's review group, which made recommendations to President Obama on NSA surveillance.
now surveillance that everybody seems to love.
Republicans and Democrats have come out in support of some kind of body camera system throughout the country.
We should make sure every police department in the country has body cameras.
Many police chiefs want body cams, and so do defense attorneys.
This week, a New York Times CBS poll found that in the wake of lethal police encounters from Ferguson to Baltimore, 92% of Americans also want body cams deployed. Attorney General Loretta Lynch has announced $20 million in grants for the equipment, but body cameras pose a legal paradox. The footage is both a government record, theoretically open to open records requests, and a sensitive recording of encounters with private citizens. A patchwork of rules has emerged as municipalities confront not just the high cost of storing and processing the footage, but the inherent conflict between transparency and privacy. The Atlantic's Robinson Myers says merely redacting the faces of citizens is a tough and pricey task.
A video captured by one of these cameras will have somewhere between 20 and 40 frames per second. I think it depends a bit on the manufacturer. And every one of those frames will need to be handled individually by a records agent for the government if it's going to be released to the public and not contain any personally identifiable information. So you think, what could that be? That could be a face. That could be a license plate number. And each of those frames, 20 to 30, will need to be processed before it can be released.
Is there a general rule of thumb on cost?
You know, you don't see a single rule on cost. What you do see is DC, which is trying to exempt all footage from open records laws. A spokesman for the mayor's office there says that it's more than 4 hours of person time to redact a minute of video. And the other number that you see is that in Florida, in Sarasota, someone there asked for all 84 hours of the city's pilot body camera program and was told that it would cost $18,000. So let's say there's something that seems illegal happens in a community, something like the Freddie Gray incident, and activists or lawyers ask for all the video in that community for the week beforehand, which wouldn't really be an unreasonable request because often officers and the people who they are talking to have some kind of history. Then you're looking at more than 84 hours, even if there's more than just two or three cops on that block.
Now, different jurisdictions have come up with different solutions or non-solutions to the problem. Can you give me some examples of what some governments have done?
So in Los Angeles, where they're about to buy about 7,000 body cameras, the LAPD considers body camera footage to be evidence and therefore not subject to open records requests. In DC, where I am, the mayor kind of actually snuck this two-line ordinance into her budget that would exempt body camera footage from open records requests. An interesting detail about DC is that the police union actually wants it to be public. It says the public has paid for this and existing FOIA regulations will be just fine. In Seattle, which lives under Washington State's very intense open records laws, and in fact, the government is actually liable for a certain amount of money per day to the requester for every day they fail to return the request. So Seattle's trying an experiment where it auto-redacts. It runs a huge blur basically on all the footage and releases it to a YouTube channel.
Can you even figure out what's going on? Isn't it just literally murky?
I think that's exactly right. You look at the footage and it looks like blurs. And in fact, when you talk to privacy experts, even the folks who are concerned about the privacy implications of police body cameras tend to be like, you know, if we release all this, it's very likely that there could be abusive behavior that you would never be able to see because all the video will look like is just these two or three blurs.
There's a fundamental tension here between our rights as citizens to see what the government is doing with our money and with our rights as citizens to have our privacy protected by that very same government. I don't think you could get 92% of Americans to agree on whether it's day or night. But isn't it that the public just hasn't thought this through?
yesterday, Massachusetts governor basically said exactly that, basically said Massachusetts isn't going to install body cameras as fast as a lot of other states are because if the public thought through all the privacy implications of them, they'd be more worried about them than they are. And he said, I actually am more worried about them than most people are.
I guess it's worth noting that in Ferguson, in Staten Island, in South Carolina, the video images came not from police body cams or dashboard cams on police cruisers, but from bystanders who had their smartphones on.
Yet every new citizen video prompts policy calls for body cameras. Body cameras have this ludicrously high public approval rating because they're perceived as neutral accountability tools that will catch cops from doing the worst kinds of activities and will deter cops. I think that will be the most interesting question of implementing body cameras nationwide is even if we don't have all the policies worked out perfectly, will merely the fact that we're recording be enough of a deterrent to see some of this abusive behavior go down?
Rob, thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me, Bob.
Robinson Meyer is an associate editor at The Atlantic, where he covers technology.
Coming up, Veeps, creator on craziness and claptrap in the nation's capital.
This is On the Media.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, Texas doctors confront the reality of the abortion ban.
A violation of the law could result in a first-degree felony charge and a fine of at least $100,000. After Roe was overturned, the message from doctors was, I'm out of here.
Revisiting the abortion laws in Texas. That's the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
And here's what you probably haven't been waiting for, another podcast recommendation. But this one is for The Sporkful, hosted by Dan Pashman, and it's really funny. It's kind of about food, but it's really about human behavior. And I recommend particularly their episode on bagels, not just because I'm in it, but because it brought attention to the sorry state of bageldom. You can find The Sporkful podcast wherever you get your podcasts or in the WNYC app. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In season 4 of Veep, now airing on HBO, the vice president, played by Julia Louis-Dreyfus, has ascended to the Oval Office along with her foul-mouthed staff.
Why this internet is sketchier than our economic forecasts?
Oh, that's because your laptop is still running on Windows 2000 and
Dan, we need to break this Cassie the British who invented the internet and anybody in between.
He knows I've got a bigger role in the White House now, which means I've got a bigger which means he can suck it.
Why are we talking about noodles?
No, let me rephrase that. Why the are we talking about noodles? Oh,
this is all Cliff's fault. That grinning Ewok. They're all in the Situation Room. I'm stuck here swearing in a load of senators.
Last month, Veep creator Armando Iannucci announced that although the show would be returning for a fifth season, he would not. I spoke to him last year while reporting on our special hour on Washington, D.C. We never aired that interview until now. Why do you suppose that Washington has suddenly become the default venue for television drama and comedy? What's so great about Washington all of a sudden?
You say great, perhaps because it's not great. When there are great swellings of support, for example, for issues like gun control, and then nothing happens. Or when invasions of other countries happen that no one was consulted on, or shutdowns happen, despite all the best brains in Washington saying that they're contriving to come up with a deal, I think people feel that they're not part of the conversation that's going on inside DC. In the news and in current affairs, there is a vacuum because, you know, politics isn't progressing. And in that vacuum, you know, come idiots like me and comedians and dramatists and turn it into entertainment.
You were a foreigner with strange foreign ideas. How did you get your arms around Washington, D.C. politics so well and so quickly?
Well, I am a bit of a political nerd. When others, when there were 13, 14 in the UK, followed football and could ream off all the statistics, I was able to tell you who won which election and by how much a majority. And especially American politics, I'm interested in how American government works. You know, I've spent a lot of time in DC talking to people who work in these buildings. And I say to them, I really want to know the dull detail. What time do you get in the morning? What's your office look like? What sort of people do you work with? And the revelation is that inside those big, grand edifices built like Roman imperial temples are just hordes and hordes of people kind of making it up as they go along.
A limestone Potemkin village you've just described.
Well, the West Wing is just a warren of tiny, tiny rooms. And in the State Department, they couldn't afford to buy chairs that matched the tables and the desks. So they got chairs that are actually too high for the desk. So you can't pull the chair in under the desk. You can't sit comfortably. And in the West Wing, there are too many chairs for each table because everyone wants to say they work in the West Wing. So they cram as many people as possible into these tiny rooms. And very respectable, powerful-looking middle-aged men in suits sitting rumpled up on spare sofas and seats in corridors because there isn't a desk for them. Everyone wants to say that they work in the West Wing. The character of Jonah is really based on someone we met who worked deep in the bowels of the West Wing. I mean, it was so in the bowels, it was part of a cave network for another state, really, by the time that you found his office. He said, actually, when you phone someone and say, I'm calling from the White House, you can hear the person on the end of the line holding the phone up to everyone else in the room, mouthing to all their colleagues, I've got someone from the White House on the other end of the line. And he said he just got a real buzz knowing that that was happening.
This character, Jonah, he's in his 20s. He is pompous and kind of clueless about the image he projects.
Are you here to spy, Jonah?
I'm not here to spy. I work at the White House, so I can just walk in and say, I'm from the White House. What the f*** are you doing?
What? You work at the White House? Oh, my God, can I bleep you?
Yes, you can. I will meet you out in the hallway in a few seconds.
Sure, I'll get a stepladder.
Anyway, I work for the White House. What the f*** are you doing?
People in Washington, they all say to me they know a Jonah. You do get other people in Washington saying, oh, I'm the Amy in the office or I'm the Dan in the office, but I know a Jonah. Somewhere there is a tomb to the unknown Jonah, somewhere in D.C.
Tell me about the Eye of Sauron.
Are you familiar with the Eye of Sauron? Fire-rimmed, all-seeing eye from Tolkien's Lord of the Rings.
I think I caught it on a plane once.
The Eye of Sauron is the near-perfect analog for the modern media. If we can draw the eye to Helsinki, then it won't be looking at what's going on here.
And what is exactly going on here?
I cannot tell you that, Mike.
Is Selena Gollum?
By releasing another story, that will take the Eye of Sauron away from Washington. In this case, it was something to do with the spy scandal in the White House and the president being caught in a lie. One of the most frightening responses I've had from people in D.C. is, you know, when an episode has gone out and it's about an issue that we completely made up, we thought this was a good farcical plot line, and then somebody comes up and says, how on earth did you find that out? For example, in the very first episode of season 3, Jonah gets fired from the West Wing for writing under a pseudonym, a kind of gossip blog about goings-on in the White House. Now, actually, some of our consultants in D.C. said to us, oh, you've got to take that out. That would never happen. Never in a million years would that happen. The very next day, someone got fired from the White House for writing an anonymous Twitter feed about what was going on in the White House. So all I can do is hold my hands up in despair and just say, see, told you.
Now, I'm not going to ask you actually to slag off other shows about Washington, but some tried to get the details right by perfectly approximating the Oval Office, for example, right? But it seems to me that you have found another path to verisimilitude. What's the secret?
For me, because comedy is a distortion, a bending of the truth, there's always a danger that you push it too far. And so our safety net really is bedding the comedy in reality. So that's why we spend a lot of time going in for the detail. And also, when we're shooting it, we get performers who can take the dialogue and make it their own, make it very naturalistic. So they're talking over each other interrupt each other, give each other funny looks. I mean, I was a big fan of, you know, some of the great Robert Altman films like Nashville and MASH. It felt real and yet it was funny at the same time because he pushed the reality.
What is the essence of Washington?
Well, it seems to me to be the same 300 or 400 people taking turns at acting as if they know what they're doing.
Armando, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Armando Iannucci is the creator of HBO's Veep. As he said, no matter how outlandish his storylines, the truth is often a whole lot more bizarre, which can create a problem for reporters confronted with real-life farce. It's an increasingly pressing problem in recent years. Killer vaccines, death panels, Kenyan presidents, the federal government blowing up the World Trade Center. So widespread are these rumors, and so intertwined in otherwise serious political debate, that the media are obliged to pay attention mainly by maddeningly anodyne exercises in, quote, fact-checking and even-handed stories riddled with false balance. But really, how in the world to cover this one?
Well, conspiracy theories are running wild tonight about the Army's plan for a multi-state training exercise this summer called Jade Helm 15.
They say a multi-state Army exercise is actually set up to institute martial law in the Lone Star State.
The site InfoWars has led the internet buzz, publishing a military PowerPoint slide showing Texas as red enemy territory.
Yes, some proclaim that Jade Helm 15, a military training exercise, is actually a plot to overthrow Texas by the federal government in league with sinister allies, ISIS and Walmart. Sure, it's the usual tinfoil hat stuff, but then the governor of Texas decided to deploy the Texas State Guard to track the movements of the U.S. military. You know, just in case. And a couple of Republican presidential candidates weighed in to say that the takeover theory doesn't sound so nutty to them, and a U.S. congressman says it's the next logical step in our descent into Obama tyranny. So, how did NPR's Wade Goodwin handle that story? Throughout his blog post titled, Texas Governor Deploys State Guard to Stave Off Obama Takeover, you could almost hear Goodwin's eyes rolling.
These are kind of like the stories you'll hear at, you know, a backyard party. Two guys standing by the fence with beers in their hands, one guy telling the other the true lowdown on what's about to happen. It just seemed the right way to approach it. I do not think it's very likely that the Green Berets and Navy SEALs are going to be used by the president to take over Texas. I mean, look, the federal government has already taken over Texas. You know, they've got us.
You mean because you're a state and all that?
It's true. I mean, this happened quite a while ago. And really, we went happily. We had 10 good years as a nation, but, you know, we thought we'd cut our losses and go with what looked like was going to be a winning team.
Now, another way for you to have gone on this was to take the factcheck.org approach, to take each of the statements by conspiracy theorists like Alex Jones or like the governor or like your congressman, Louis Gohmert, and hold them up to scrutiny and then simply use plain language to say, no, this doesn't check out, this doesn't check out. You know, that's one way to handle it.
Once you open up the internet and start looking at Jade Helm, you find a fascinating conspiracy theory that connects all different types of ideas. I mean, we have Walmarts, we have train cars that have been outfitted with shackles to transport political prisoners to these Walmarts, which would be political processing centers. These would be people whose guns were going to be taken by force, and then anyone who resisted that would end up on the train in shackles and eventually at Walmart. And then there's this ISIS element. ISIS has come across the border and has set up camp just outside of El Paso, and there's some Mexican public officials there. I'm not quite sure why. That's why we have to send the special forces in to take out ISIS. And while they're doing that, that's going to be the excuse to go ahead and impose martial law. And I was like, wow, okay. So you know, fact-checking that seemed, I guess, just too much. So rather than fact-check it, I just put it out there.
Now, Wade, in a moment, I'm going to let our listeners hear what your magnificent, laconic West Texas drawl sounds like when you're making fun of the governor.
Bob, that's a Central Texas accent there, son.
Oh, my God. Okay, hold a second. Your magnificent, laconic, Central Texas drawl. But first, I want to ask you, you know, maybe my own wingnut question, and that is, do you think that what you've done here is the kind of mainstreaming of the John Stewartization of news? That is to say, performing our watchdog function by any means possible, including and maybe especially ridicule. Do you think this is a journalistic technique that has some legs to it?
I think it's possible to have some fun and have it not be ugly and have it not be sneering, condescending toward other people. Even people whose political ideas might seem a little far out there. I mean, I actually hope that, you know, when you finish reading the piece I wrote, that while maybe it might spur you to roll your eyes, you don't think that I was sneering or condescending, because, in fact, that's not how I feel. I know from my own reporting that sometimes these folks can be right, and I don't necessarily think they are this time, but I hope there's some room in between having some humor in a piece and have it be mean-spirited.
Well, you're a better person than me. Now, I think we want to hear a bit of you talking to David Green on the follow-up piece on Jade Helm 15. But Wade, it's a delight.
And I think we'll all be resting easier here in Texas, knowing our tax dollars are being well spent on the state guard so they can keep a sharp eye on the military, our military, so they can't get up to any shenanigans.
Wade, thank you very, very much.
It's been my pleasure.
Wade Goodwin is an NPR correspondent based in the Lone Star State. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Kasia Mihailovich, and Jesse Brenneman. We had more help from Jenna Cagle. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Greg Rippon.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.